This episode of the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters podcast is brought to you by the Podbean podcast app. The Podbean podcast app is the top available podcast app around. You can get instant updates of my new podcasts or others that you listen to directly to your app. It's free, easy to use, and gives you all the features you need to help discover new podcasts and even create your own. Whether you use an Android or iPhone device, this app is the podcast app for you. Get the Podbean podcast app now on Google Play or Apple's App Store and start enjoying more from the podcast that you love. Welcome to the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters show. My name is Kieran Pedley. Well, I was off last week, so there's lots to cover in this week's episode. We'll be talking a bit about the Labour leadership contest, which, believe it or not, still rumbles on. Is it inevitable that Jeremy Corbyn's going to win? We'll also be talking about a treasure trove of Lord Ashcroft polling, about what the public wants from Brexit, but also talking about the brands of the different parties and political leaders. We'll also make some time to talk about the junior doctors' strike and what the public think about sort of industrial action in the UK, and we might even have some time to talk about the US presidential race too. Now, I'm joined by polling experts Katie Owen from Common Vision. Katie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Leo Barassi, of course, as people will know, is editor of Noise of the Crowd, but also regular contributor to Polling Matters. Leo, welcome.
Hi, Kieran.
So, as usual, guys, we're going to do the new format of the show where each of us picks a sort of polling-related topic and talks it through. I think, Leo, for your topic, you were going to talk about our last episode and something that Don Brin said about the Labour leadership contest.
That's right. So, most viewers and listeners, I imagine, will have come across the Labour leadership poll, which has given Corbyn a pretty commanding lead. He's got a 24-point lead over his rival Owen Smith. Now, given that YouGov were spot on with the last leadership election, and they were the first to tell us that unexpectedly Jeremy Corbyn was going to win, this looks pretty bad. This looks like it's over, and there's not really much point us paying much attention to it. But your guest on the last episode, Don Brind of Saving Labour, thinks that these numbers are not right. And his argument, I think, at first glance, seems kind of plausible. He says that YouGov's panel was constituted before the two-week window for registered supporters to join. And being from Saving Labour, he says they know that 120,000 people signed up to join as registered supporters and that they're not on the YouGov panel. So it's interesting. Of the full members, Corbyn has a lead of, I think it's 57-43 when you take out the don't-knows, which means it is still just about possible, even if that doesn't change, for Smith to win if he has a commanding lead among registered supporters. So if union affiliates and full members stay the same, then Smith with a lead of 75%, or not a lead, but 75% over 25% among registered supporters would do it. Now, that sounds like a lot, and it's a bit of a stretch. And kind of at this point, I think my belief in this argument starts crumbling. So I had a chat with YouGov about this, and they're pretty clear that actually people joined their panel quite a while ago, but they, YouGov, have updated to find out who has registered as a Labour supporter, and they don't think there's any reason to believe that the 120,000 sign-ups that Saving Labour think they have aren't on the panel. So YouGov are pretty confident. They've heard Don Brin's criticism, and they say, yeah, we think our numbers are right. And their arguments seem fairly solid, which means this 24-point lead that Corbyn has over Smith feels fairly solid.
I mean, Kate, it does seem like the narrative in Westminster at the moment is that Jeremy Corbyn's kind of sort of heading for an inevitable victory in September. I mean, do you share that view?
I think I probably do. And I think there's a couple of other things that I saw in this leadership poll from YouGov that gave me that impression. And one of them is if you look at the people who told YouGov that they were undecided, now a really small sample, I probably shouldn't be talking about it at all, and I'm not going to quote any figures, but When you looked at the sort of attributes that respondents were presented with, they were presented with a list of sort of positive words and a list of negative words, and asked if they would use any of those to describe either Smith or Corbyn. If you look at those undecided, it's around 8% in the sample, they generally seem to think that Jeremy is principled, and quite overwhelmingly he's principled, that he's got good values, that he's honest. They don't think he's strong, they don't think he's competent, and that to my mind would be where Owen would have a kind of a way in, possibly. I mean, possibly that sample is that size is so small that, you know, even if he won over every single one of them, he would still lose on these numbers. But if you look at those same descriptions for Owen Smith, they're not much better, and he's not considered much more strong or competent than even Jeremy is. And I think perhaps if a different candidate had gone up against Jeremy, who could sort of win over that portion of the electorate who think Jeremy is really wonderful but maybe not doing a great job, there might have been more success, but it doesn't look like look that way. I think another interesting thing in that poll is the gender breakdown as well. Corbyn doing a lot better among women even versus among men, so I think Owen might be regretting some of the comments he's made over the last few months.
I mean, I noticed a couple of findings myself, one of them being that, I mean, I think it's a point that's been made regularly before, which is that Owen Smith win. If there was no additional members joining the Labour Party since the last general election, probably remember that, it was a little while ago now, wasn't it? Owen Smith comfortably wins amongst the membership, but he wins, Jeremy Corbyn wins 86% of new Labour members from September, so since Jeremy Corbyn became leader. So in terms of the membership, at least, it's very much a new political party. Another observation that I had, which I thought was interesting, was around the age breaks. Now, there is this narrative that Jeremy Corbyn is this guy that has lots of support amongst young people. And I think a lot of that is based on Westminster polls that show young people more likely to vote Labour. But that's something that I think we see fairly often, whoever the leader of the Labour Party is, rather than just Jeremy Corbyn. And actually, I think you found that in the poll, 62% of the sample said they would vote for Jeremy Corbyn, but only 61% of the 18 to 24s. And that suggests there's no particularly overwhelmingly strong support amongst sort of new young Labour members. It seems to be a sort of, it's not an age thing, it's something else is going on. But let's move on to some other polling, because I think this isn't necessarily new news, although it's interesting that you're confident that YouGov seem to have this right. If you move to the wider electorate, Labour seems to have a problem, doesn't it? Because, you know, we've looked in the past on the show a lot about Theresa May versus Jeremy Corbyn on who would make the best Prime Minister and so forth. But I think Lord Ashcroft had some polling out, didn't he, that talked about the party brands.
I'm trying to remember the last time that I was on your show and said, this poll has good news for Labour, but I'm going to say it. This poll was surprisingly good for Labour in an unexpected way. So, look, OK, we know that the Tories have what we might call a ridiculous lead in vote intent, that it's unprecedented how far behind the opposition is and so on and so on. But there was a really interesting set of questions in the Ashcroft poll about the values that people attribute to the parties. And you know, these questions are asked quite a lot, but they don't get that much attention. So people said, do they think Labour displays is attributed to have particular characteristics, like the soft things like it helps ordinary people, its heart's in the right place, it's on the side of people like me. Now, we always know that Labour does reasonably well on that. One of its strongest values was help ordinary people with 44%. And then there's a set of harder values, competent and capable, will do what they say, take tough decisions. Again, we always know Labour does reasonably badly with that, or at least it has done for a while. But the thing that I found really interesting about this is I look back at an Ashcroft poll from 2 years ago under Miliband, September 2014. At the time, us naive people thought that Labour was on its way to forming the government. And actually, weirdly, those numbers haven't moved at all. So Labour's vote intent has gone down quite a bit. But but actually people's underlying view of what, how they think the party is doing, what it stands for, who it's for, what its basic principles are, interestingly, it hasn't changed. So I might look at that and think, well, actually, people are kind of seeing this as a superficial. The Labour Party is one thing, and the leader, who I don't like, is another. Get rid of the leader, and I'll listen to the party again. Now, this surprised me, because there's a lot of talk about the damage Corbyn's doing to the Labour brand. But it seems to me that looking at this, that actually, at least over the last couple of years, the brand hasn't been harmed.
Although the Conservatives still seem to lead in that poll on taking the tough decisions.
It would be fair to say I'm comparing with a time where, actually, in retrospect, Labour wasn't doing that well. So, you know, you could challenge me and say, OK, compare this to 2001, 2002, and I'm sure the numbers are a lot lower now. But my point is just specifically that from this, there's no evidence, as far as I can tell, that Corbyn and his leadership has damaged broader perceptions of the Labour Party.
Let's move on to my topic. Speaking of tough decisions to be made, I think Theresa May's got a few of her own. I was looking at other questions in that Lord Ashcroft poll around Brexit, and I wrote an article on political betting, which I think a lot of people listening in or watching, may have seen, where I looked at some of the detailed polling Lord Ashcroft did around essentially what do people want from Brexit. And at the moment, there is this idea that it's a trade-off between the single market and controlling immigration. And people dispute that. Some people on the right of the Conservative Party say, no, there's no trade-off, we're just leaving the single market anyway, we're just going to have a new relationship. Fine. So leaving that to one side, though, there is this idea that there is eventually going to have to be some trade-off, and that's what we think. And one of the questions caught my eye on this, which was Lord Ashcroft gave a 0 to 10 point scale and asked people to place essentially themselves on it in terms of what their priority was. Was it controlling immigration or was it access to the single market? And he presented some numbers that showed 52% were in favour of controlling immigration, if you like, or prioritised controlling immigration, and 28% said access to the single market. Now, I have a bit of a sort of bee in my bonnet about this poll question. And the reason is that the way it's kind of, the wording is slightly difficult. I would argue that controlling immigration is a much easier thing to understand than access to the single market. I mean, access to the single market is quite a sort of, I don't know, abstract theory. And what does it mean? Does it, you know, if it's tied to jobs or if it's tied to even economic growth, which it, you know, in itself is not necessarily an easy to understand term, then these numbers might be different. But beyond that, actually, there is an argument that if you cut the numbers a different way, so if you look at the number of people that gave a score of 4, 5, 6 or 7, I think it was 35% that gave sort of score in the middle. So actually you can slice and dice these numbers in lots of different ways to come up with lots of different answers in terms of what the public's priorities are, in the context of which we don't necessarily know that the public are that well informed. I mean, how could they be? I mean, who knows what's going to happen in terms of what comes next? I mean, Katie, I'll bring you in. There are other points I want to raise, but it feels like we're sort of scrabbling around in the dark a little bit to try and understand what Brexit means Brexit is actually going to mean. Do you think it's difficult for polling to actually give that answer if you're the government trying to understand what voters think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really hard because it's not even just about the deal that's made. And I mean, the idea that the government can both have full control over immigration and our borders and also, you know, the best possible deal in terms of the single market and also not contribute any funding to the EU budget, which I think would be three things that the public would want. I mean, that's impossible. I would be astounded if even the best negotiators in the world that we could possibly hire would be able to get us that deal. Not least because the terms of Article 50 are really not in favour of the country that's leaving, they're in favour of the remaining member states. So, yes, I think it's really difficult for a government to kind of take those three things and decide, okay, if we're going to choose between whether it be controlling immigration or access to the single market, which should we pick? Because it's not just a question of what do people say they would prefer, it's a question of what's going to have the best sort of longer-term success as well, or even shorter-term success. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the decision is made that Brexit means leaving the EU entirely, having no access to the single market so that we can have a strict immigration policy, and that's all done, and yet, you know, we launch ourselves into a recession and all sorts of other negative things happen, that's not going to be seen as a success, even if people now, a majority of people, say that they would be fine with that. So, yeah, there's lots of things to consider, and I certainly wouldn't want to be in government right now, I don't think.
I mean, Leo, what do you think about some of these numbers? And I'm going to look at some of these others, where Lord Ashcroft asked people to sort of pick the top three issues facing the country and then you and your family. I've picked the top four here on this slide in terms of in order to see what people said. And I want to read them out and get your impression of what they say. So the top four issues facing the country: EU withdrawal on right terms, 64%. Wasn't worded exactly that way, but it's just for the arguments, for the sake of brevity. So 64% said sort of withdrawing from the EU, not surprising. Brexit, you know, we just voted for Brexit. Number two, the economy / jobs, 56%. NHS, 47%. Immigration in fourth with 46%. So, you know, EU withdrawal, number one. You and your family, cost of living becomes number one, 56%. NHS, 55%. Economy, jobs, 47%. And then in fourth place, EU withdrawal on the right terms, 44%. So clearly people are able to distinguish what matters to the country and what matters to them. How do you interpret some of that?
Well, as ever, the impact on people's everyday lives is the thing that comes through most powerfully. I mean, I suppose there's two striking things from this. The first is, I mean, immigration is a slightly tricky one, because I think I take your point that people see it as a national issue slightly more than as a local issue. And, you know, we know that immigration concerns are often strong in areas that don't actually have much immigration. But the point is that people do see that as a national issue. And I think that's how the Leave campaign really targeted their message much more effectively than Remain, because they got that control, even if it's not something that people are experiencing in their day-to-day life, is the key thing. So I think the fact that it doesn't appear in the top four issues for people's day-to-day lives, I think, could be misleading, that I think the government has to show that they've got an answer on that. But I mean, the second thing is that access to the single market isn't an either-or, that, you know, there are different kinds of things that we might have access to a single market for. And where I think there's a real problem for the UK economy is we've had, getting on for a decade, of financial services utterly failing to protect and rebuild their reputation in the country. Now, if the rest of Europe offers the government a deal where we're allowed fairly good access for manufacturing and you know, sort of what people would think of as normal jobs, but financial services are absolutely stuffed, and in return we get some kind of decent immigration controls, well, it's going to be pretty tough for the government not to take that. They take the immigration box, they do what feels to most people like a sort of jobs protecting thing, and, you know, guess what? They get to stuff the bankers as well. I mean, you know, that's going to be pretty difficult for the government to resist. Sure, it's an economy thing, and sure, it's going to completely tank the country, and we're going to lose a huge chunk of tax revenue, but it's going to be a tough thing to resist if and when that's offered.
I mean, I look at these numbers and try and sort of get in the mindset of what the government will be thinking, because clear in their mind will be that whatever we do when we have to make hard decisions is going to annoy lots of people. There are going to be, at least the UKIP are going to say betrayal, regardless almost of what happens. And given that 48% backed Remain in the first place, it stands to reason that you're going to upset quite a lot of people quite quickly, depending on what happens. So now, maybe looking at things as a trade-off between immigration and the economy or single market isn't right, because a lot of people say, well, we're just going to leave the single market anyway, and what does access mean, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I think what strikes me that the government should keep in mind is that when people look at the issues that affect them and their family, issues around the economy and the NHS are in people's minds. And I guess they have to bear that in mind as they try and negotiate a deal, because I think if the economy does tank, if there is pressure on the NHS, it may be unrelated to Brexit, or we won't know until it happens, people are all of a sudden going to have a very different view on the importance of immigration relative to those things. So it would be foolish of me to try and argue that immigration is unimportant. Clearly, I think it was a motivating salient issue that led to us leaving the European Union. But you can't forget all the other things, I think, if you're going to get a deal that can garner majority support, basically, and keep Theresa May's numbers where they are. I would also wonder whether there may be some form of second referendum in the end. Kate, I'll get your point on that before it becomes your topic. I've made this argument, and people disagree with me, but I think there's going to be a big incentive for Theresa May to put any deal she comes up with to the British people and to validate it with a majority in order to basically placate the people that aren't happy, given that there's going to be so many people that are noisy and disgruntled. I mean, what do you think about that? Or is just a second referendum too much hassle?
I think it's a really interesting point, and I do think that, as you say, there's a real danger in it looking like the government has just taken an executive decision on what Brexit means, and they've gone for it, and if it doesn't work out, they'll get all the blame. And it also feels actually quite undemocratic, given that we've just had a referendum and taken a democratic decision to leave the EU. It feels like we do need a bit more democracy, or at least a little bit more discussion and debate about what that looks like. But in practical terms, holding another referendum is incredibly dangerous, and I have a feeling that May is, you know, she's already presented herself and comes across as much more cautious than her predecessor. I would be shocked.
Wisely so.
Yeah, I would be shocked if she would follow his sort of gung ho attitude towards referenda and go for another one. But
that's a good point. I mean, let's move on to your topic. We were talking about the NHS a moment ago. You've been looking at some polling that's kind of related.
Yeah. So kind of going beyond. You know, moving away from the Brexit debate, I suppose, as difficult as it is to do sometimes. There's been an interesting poll out from YouGov on attitudes, public attitudes to the junior doctors' strike. Just to recap on the history of it, just in case everyone listening doesn't or watching isn't aware, so junior doctors had a strike. I actually forget the date of when they struck. Was it towards the end of last year? There were subsequent negotiations with the government. There's been a sort of proffered contract, which I think BMA agreed to, but then the doctors themselves voted against. BMA then took the decision to hold a further series of strikes. The first one was due, I think, the 12th of September, but it's actually been postponed, but there's still several more in the autumn and winter. And what this poll suggests from looking at the timeline, YouGov have been kind of tracking this issue, which is always really helpful when the pollsters do that, is only a slight majority for support. And it's been one of the striking things about this strike, is that, you know, majority public support for a strike in the NHS. That's been actually, I think, something that for doctors has really sort of held them up a little bit, I suppose, in the face of
fear. For the benefit of those listening, it was once upon a time roughly 2-1 in favour of the right to go on strike, that the doctors were right to go on strike. Not quite that big, but and then now it's 42% say the doctors are right, 38% say they're wrong.
Yes. So still slightly more, but, you know, it's pretty much neck and neck. I mean, something that might give junior doctors heart is that, you know, they're still doing a lot better than pretty much any other profession who's gone on strike recently. You know, like, look back at a poll by YouGov around a teacher strike back in 2014, and, you know, clear majority opposed that strike. So there's still clearly some sympathy, but I think the public kind of moving with the media and certain other kind of doctors who've come out saying that continuing this industrial action is not best for patient safety. Which is interesting. I think there's a couple of other kind of elements to this. And one is about kind of thinking from it from the other side, I suppose, so from the government side, about perhaps a warning that they shouldn't take these figures too much to, as an endorsement of the ongoing strategy of Jeremy Hunt of kind of just going for it anyway and not conceding too much. I mean, I again look back at a similar example. Thinking about the concept of the seven-day NHS, which I suppose is what this fight is over, and a poll, again, I think put out by YouGov, showed overall support for the concept of the seven-day NHS, but a general belief that there's not enough resources to put it in place. And I think that's then reflected in this general support for the doctors striking, you know, the understanding that this is a great idea, but doesn't mean that it works in practice. And I think that in general is a bit of a warning for government. And I think it was Nick Clegg who described the seven-day NHS policy as a sort of failure of focus group politics. You know, you go out and speak to the public and you think, oh, yes, these guys are really in favour of the seven-day NHS or, you know, massive tax cuts or whatever it would be. But in practice, can you actually implement that and does that actually work? Another example, as I say, is a bedroom tax, which I think looking at, again, as YouGov tracked polling over it from 2013 when it was kind of first proposed and implemented into 2014, and went from overwhelming support, I think around 50% to around a third opposing, to almost the opposite about a year later. So a majority opposing the bedroom tax. And again, it's about how it's implemented. Yeah. It's about how it's perceived. And I think that's this strike and the whole concept of seven-day NHS is another example.
I was looking at some of these numbers earlier before we started recording, and I'll bring you in, Leah. It was quite surprising to me because there's two different things going on. On the one hand, support for the doctors is waning, or it appears to be at least. And I guess that's a lesson about how long these things can rumble on, I suppose, and how much patience people have, pardon the pun. But on the other hand, when you look at who was to blame, there seemed to be a sort of an overwhelming, you know, playing the blame game, so to speak. There did seem to be a sort of overwhelming, well, the voters were more like, respondents in the poll were more likely to blame the government than the BMA, for example. I mean, what's your interpretation on some of these numbers?
So it sort of feels like there's a communications problem. I mean, it feels intuitively like this time it's been handled pretty badly. The BMA hadn't really worked out how they were going to explain the fact that they had said that this contract was fine and then they were going on strike about it anyway. So there was clearly that. So it felt intuitively right that the numbers should fall. But actually, I think they might just be on a tougher pitch now. So you go back to April this year and government approval was minus 26. Now, after the referendum and the new government, it's only minus 4, which is the highest it's been for a long time. Minus, you know, it's still not great. But the point is, the government is just a lot more liked now than it was a few months ago. And I sort of, you know, in that context, I guess it's not that surprising that people are going to be a bit more sympathetic to it and a bit less sympathetic to the doctors. But, I mean, as you say, so we've got 40% saying that the government's most to blame, 16% saying the BMA's most to blame, and 27% saying both sides equally. So people are still kind of holding it against the government, though now, for the first time, they're not in the majority.
What do you make of the use of the word BMA in that question wording? I wonder whether if you said it was the government versus the doctors, would it be different? I mean, we can't know that for sure, but...
So, yeah, it's interesting, I suppose, to be honest, how many people know what the BMA is? If that's the question wording, I'd be interested. I mean, we've got 17% don't knows there, and, you know, it's almost half a don't know or both sides equally. So, you know, perhaps actually what's going on is we're overestimating the attention that people have paid to the details of what's happening.
Mm. I mean, let's move on to our final topic. I'll bring up a second topic for this week's show. Talk about Donald Trump. I've been over in the States for a week on holiday, as one does, and I was sort of following the coverage as I was anyway, but I was looking at some of the numbers, but numbers too, but following some of the coverage over in the States, I was left with this impression that I maybe had got this race a little bit wrong in the last sort of 6 months. I had this assumption that Hillary Clinton was a lock, to use a US phrase. She was inevitably going to win, and Trump just couldn't help putting his foot in his mouth and, come on, guys, let's be honest, Hillary Clinton's going to be the next president. Now, that may yet still be the case, but I came away from sort of watching the coverage thinking that Donald Trump has a much, much better chance of winning than I'd given him credit for. And I suspect a lot of people in Britain give him credit for too. Now, I suppose the difficulty is you have to try to separate whether you like him or not from actually objectively looking at his chances, which is never an easy thing to do. And I think it's fair to say overwhelming majority in this country dislike him. But 538, Nate Silver's gang, if you like, give him a 1 in 3 chance of becoming the next president using their kind of polls-only forecast. And regular listeners to the podcast and viewers will know that they use a bunch of different forecasts. Now, we'll go into that in a bit more detail next week. But a 1 in 3 chance is actually, you know, a lot. It's not 50-50, but it's a bigger chance than maybe you might expect. Mm-hmm. And last week it was easy to see why. Last week, the whole media agenda was around his big speech on immigration. So it meant the agenda was about immigration, so the campaign was being fought on his terms. He went to do a press conference with the Mexican president and didn't stuff it up. And meanwhile, the sort of side order, if you like, to the media agenda was the Clinton Foundation and ideas of cash for access, along with this rumbling email saga, which I think people have almost forgotten about why it's controversial, but it just seems to feed this narrative of Hillary Clinton being distrustful. Now, I may very well have been there on a week that just happened to be bad for Hillary Clinton and good for Donald Trump. I fully sort of accept that. But just seeing him on the TV screens night after night as the Republican nominee and dominating the news cycle just made me a lot less comfortable with the prospect of Clinton winning than I once was. And if you look at some of the numbers behind that, I think that sort of substantiates it. Now, Gallup had a poll out this week which is relatively indicative of what's going on generally, which has 58% of Americans unfavourable towards Hillary Clinton, 63% unfavourable towards Donald Trump. So I suppose the way to look at this race is not that it's a kind of credible, experienced candidate in Hillary Clinton that, you know, is probably going to end up winning versus this joke candidate, how on earth did he get the nomination anyway, surely he won't win. It's actually, to Americans, it's a lesser of two evils. And although Donald Trump is extremely unpopular, Hillary Clinton is also extremely unpopular, maybe with some different people. But I want to get both of your impressions on this. I mean, Katie, I'll come to you. I mean, I don't know how closely you're following the US race, but my impression is very much that, okay, you can cop it. I can have a cop out and say Hillary Clinton's still more likely to win. But I wonder whether we're sleepwalking into a bit of a Brexit situation again, where everyone assumes the result's going to be one way and we're in for a rude awakening in November.
I think we might be. I mean, I have exactly the same impression as you about this sort of double unfavourability. I mean, there's 5 points in it. That's hardly anything. And I think my assumption as well has probably always been that people who... people will vote to stop Trump winning because they want a safe candidate. And Clinton seems, from this side of the Atlantic, like, as you say, a sort of safe, sensible person to be president. But actually, those unfavorability ratings suggest that it's precisely, it's a choice between someone who's perceived as, you know, possibly corrupt and, you know...
Establishment as well, establishment, I think it's a word you hear a lot.
Corrupt establishment, you know, really, really nasty in that sense versus the sort of... Yes, maybe slightly maverick, but you know, in touch with the people option. And yeah, I think it seems like a real possibility, isn't it? Terrifying.
Leo, reassure some of the listeners and viewers that I've gone off my rocker and that Hillary Clinton's really going to win after all. Or what's your assessment?
Right, I think you are still largely on your rocker. I don't completely. This is generous of me. I don't completely disagree with anything that you said. And you know, look, I mean, I think we're all scarred by the last couple of major votes we've had in this country, and actually, kind of how wrong we've got it. But to a large part, how wrong we've got it by not paying more attention to the polls and by not thinking more carefully about the polls. And hey, here's another one where the polls are saying it's looking quite close. And so, and you know, that goes against our instincts that it's going to be one way. So maybe we should pay attention to the polls. But there is one pretty major factor that is pretty much by its nature not factored into the polls. And as far as I know, not factored into 538's models, which is Clinton has a ground game and Trump doesn't. And I know, again, you know, regular UK politicos will be looking at that and thinking, oh yeah, hang on, what, Labour's million doorstep conversations? What happened to that? But this is different. Clinton does have much, much, you know, on an order of magnitude different, more competent organisers, officers, volunteers, and that could mean a couple of percentage points, possibly enough to make quite a major difference in terms of turnout, door knocking, getting people to register the fact that this is happening, to turn out and vote. And ultimately, we're not really ever going to see that until election day. So that's kind of squeaky bum time to be relying on that and thinking Trump's probably going to underperform his numbers and Clinton probably isn't. Mm. But I do think that is something that is relevant. And hey, if it's not, then no one should bother organising a grand game again, because you know, there's a lot of work that goes into it. And if Trump can prove that you don't need to do it, then, well, that's interesting.
I think the caveat, I mean, I think that's completely fair. Another point to add, though, is that it's around 1 in 5 right now claiming that they'll vote for someone else. So maybe Gary Johnson, former governor of New Mexico, I think, who's eating up a lot of these never-Trump voters from the Republican side. So there is churn in the race. And I guess what I would say is that, and there are a fairly large amount of undecideds as well. So I guess whereas sort of 4 years ago, the polls were relatively consistent and Obama was the incumbent, this time you've got two really unpopular candidates, but majority of Americans are unfavourable towards both of them. So clearly there are people out there, by definition, who are saying, don't like either of them, but I'm going to have to vote for somebody. Some of them are saying, I'll vote for Gary Johnson or I'll vote for somebody else. I wonder whether that will hold. Perhaps it will. I mean, it has in the past. But there are also a few states to bring to people's attention too that I think is worth looking at. Because as we know, it's about the Electoral College. It's not about the popular vote, although by definition they are largely linked. No one's going to win by 6 points and lose the Electoral College. You can win the popular vote and lose the Electoral College. Just ask Al Gore. But these Midwestern states, such as Ohio, which we know is traditionally very important, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Iowa, I'm not sure I'd call it Midwestern, but around that, those sorts of places, these are the sort of Trump territory where I can see there being an argument for a Brexit-style situation where a large number of people that don't normally vote rock up and do for Trump on this occasion. I don't think you can see it as a sort of nationwide thing, because America is not one monolithic, you know, block, if you like, of voters. But that's the area where I'd be looking. Now, people would counteract me by saying, well, look, a lot of these Midwestern states have voted blue for a very long time. And in fact, I think you have to go back to Reagan to look at the last time a lot of them didn't. Mm. So actually, maybe Trump does get close, but ultimately Hillary Clinton holds those states, maybe wins some others like Arizona, and she wins comfortably. But that's just where that whole Brexit thing I can see happening in the states. And I think a couple of months ago, I was very cynical when people talked about, oh, well, Brexit's happened, so Trump could happen. Mm. And I said, well, look, I think I said on the show, look, it's a completely different country. Just because one thing happens doesn't mean the other things happen. Now looking at it again, I'm just not so sure. I mean, the debates are coming up in a couple of weeks' time. I mean, Katie, how important would you say these presidential debates are?
I think
they're always important, but in the grand scheme of things.
Yeah, I think they are important, and probably particularly when it's a close race, and so much about this seems to be about personality, and I think that's probably usually the case in the States. It's very much a more personality-led election than the general elections we have here. So I think they'll be crucial, and I think also very interesting and entertaining to watch, quite possibly.
Leo, final word to you on this. In those debates and looking forward to the campaign, what do you think each candidate's got to actually do to try and sort of prevail?
Well, politics is always about expectation management, and I think the debates here are going to be ever more so than usual. That, I mean, you alluded to it, that we've seen that Trump's had pretty good coverage because he managed to go to Mexico without what punching anyone or you know, actually swearing at the president on camera. And you know, the debate's going to be similar. That up until they happen, the Clinton camp is going to be trying to change the message, change the way that it's judged, so that it's not just, you know, Trump has to be able to stand on stage and not fall over, and you know, Clinton Clinton has to sort of, you know, recreate some stunning oratory. And that's the huge challenge. And I think that's quite difficult because, you know, the expectation is very much that Trump is incapable and Clinton is the experienced insider, and challenging that is going to be difficult.
Certainly a race to keep our eyes on, as I'm sure we will. Leo and Katie, thank you very much for your time. And that's all we've got time for this week's PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters show. Lots to talk about in the upcoming party conference season, of course. But join us next week when we'll be looking at the American race more closely with some special guests and looking at what we might expect in November. You've been listening to the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters podcast, which is brought to you by the Podbean podcast app. The Podbean podcast app is the top podcast app around. You can get instant updates of your new favourite podcasts directly to your Podbean podcast app. It's free, easy to use, and lets you easily discover new podcasts that you love and also publish your own podcast too. Whether you use an Android device or an iPhone device, this app is the app for you. So get the new Podbean podcast app today on Google Play or Apple App Store. Enjoy more from the podcasts that you love.